I'm gonna start with Chris. Can you tell us what makes a great negotiator?
Well, something really boring to start off with. Listening.
Oh, sorry.
Now, listening, it sounds like the least sexy thing on the planet. But being able to listen between the lines and actually, I'll give you two things. Listening first, and what does that mean? Well, forgive me for bringing him up, but a friend of mine in Los Angeles, where I live now, Ned Colletti, former manager of the Dodgers. They hated Dodgers, right? But he was talking about when he negotiated with sports agents. He said in a 2-hour conversation, it's going to be 90 seconds of solid gold, and I got to listen to find that 90 seconds of solid gold. Now the second part of that then is another word that's going to sound horrible, but confrontation. And I was talking with Cindy when we first met, and both these ladies are fantastic at confrontation. And it's but it's
what do you mean, Chris?
See, No, but it's being able. Confrontation sometimes is just showing something to someone, letting them see it. And how can you present something to someone that makes them see it? Now, you have to listen long enough to find out what it is that you have to present to them. But one definition of confrontation is a focused comparison. And so what you have to get good at is comparing what people are saying with what they're doing or what's happening. And so you have to listen to figure out what that is, and then you have to find a way to show it to them. And that's a completely different way to look at confrontation. So I think it's actually those two things together.
Constance, what do you think makes a great negotiator?
I agree with Chris. You have to listen. And it took me quite some time in my career to figure that out, because you just automatically, but you interrupt. You want to not necessarily disagree, but you want the other person to see your point of view. But without listening and realizing who you're negotiating against, because everybody's different. So some people are confrontational. Some people take the passive aggressive. So I think a lot of it is listening, but then also seeing who your opponent is. And they are an opponent. I mean, not in a negative way, but they are an opponent.
So, Chris, you know, one of the hostage negotiations that you're best known for and you write about in the book is the D.C. sniper case. I don't know if people remember back in Washington several years ago. You were very involved in that as the FBI's lead hostage negotiator. Can you tell us a little about what was going on in that case and what your role was?
Well, we for those of you, we thought it was one sniper back in Washington, D.C. It's been over 10 years now. And it ended up being two of them that were going around shooting people randomly. Communication can be actions. Negotiation can be actions. Negotiation, not just words. Well, one thing we always phrase I like is most dangerous negotiation is one you don't know you're in. That cuts either forward. There's no neutral ground on that. It either cuts in your direction or you'll be in a negotiation before you know it. So we looked at what the snipers were doing as communication, that they wanted something. They were communicating with their actions. They were communicating through violence. And we started to, and actually we found out we were right because they got frustrated because they'd actually been calling law enforcement for a while. They started leaving messages at the scenes of the shootings. They were trying to communicate. They ultimately wanted $10 million. So we looked at that as communication, and then when we finally discovered it, you know, as absurd as it sounds, I was running the negotiation team the morning they called in to speak to us. We found out that they'd actually been calling law enforcement for about 10 days. You know, it was classic, ridiculous comedy. They called one tip line for the sniper, and the operator didn't know who she was talking to, and she actually said, no, you've got the wrong number. You got to call somebody else. Imagine that. You know, the serial killers call in. Now, let me put you on hold while I transfer you. They also got one of the executive assistants to one of the chiefs of police in the D.C. metro area. They got him on the phone and spoke to him. He thought it was a joke. And didn't take a message, didn't follow up, you know, and hung up on him. And I think the guy ended up losing his position after it came out that he'd actually spoken to him on the phone. So it was a series of communication. And so then the most dangerous negotiation is one you don't know you're in. All right, so if they're communicating via actions, what does this mean? What's the commodity that they're after? How do they want to engage? And we engaged with them on the phone, and it contributed to how they were caught. And even more importantly, it contributed to them when they tried to put forward an insanity defense later on in court. It showed that they were conscious of what they were doing and what they were after. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, very much like what you said, reading the other side. You know, you listen so you can read the other side, figure out what they're thinking, what they're doing.
So maybe not a life or death situation like you're normally working in, but Constance was very involved in Michael Strahan leaving Live with Kelly, getting him that job in the first place on Live with Kelly and then going to GMA. And I don't know if you've seen last week's People magazine cover story. So what can you tell us about those negotiations? Because I think for those of us that were just reading about it, you know, we were probably getting one perspective and it seemed like people were taking sides. But what was it really like behind the scenes?
I think a big part of what we learned was that... I guess you
gunshot.
Can't lean back. I'm so sorry, everybody. No, okay, I'm just going to sit like this. Sorry. Negotiation with the
It's a good
guy.
Stalling technique
do?
In a negotiation,
but
right? To have your mic go out for a second.
Sit still? Okay. So it was intense. I don't know if any of you saw or heard about when Conan and Jay Leno, and they turned it into a documentary, and I as a fan, you know, was watching and like, how could something like this happen? Like, these are smart people. Like, these are top-level executives at the networks. And I understand now. So what I've learned about that is when you're dealing with big corporations, people might be sitting this close to one another and they don't communicate. So for us, the key was over-communication, which might not have appeared like there was over-communication, but behind the scenes, there's a lot of communication, over-communication. And we had to stop really just following what the media was saying because half of it is not true. Half of it is just the salacious gossip magazines, which I hope everybody, you know, don't read and buy. And what we definitely just stayed true was to ourselves and just remembered that it was the same boss, you know, of both television shows employed by ABC asking for this to happen. So I think the key for us was, you know, you get the people that you trust in the room together, you have the same message points, and we really just hunkered down and just wrote it out.
And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of press from Michael talking about this afterwards, and then this article came out all these months later. So I'm curious how you sort of negotiate the collateral damage or the negative publicity and then come out with a cover story like this months later.
So people had offered a cover at the same time, you know, right after Kelly had her cover, and we just said, you know what, this isn't, you know, we're done. You know, we did what he was told to do by the executives, he made the move, and let's just get through this and let's enjoy the summer and go spend time with your family. And then when it's time to come back for not just his, you know, the new beginnings at GMA full time, but also back to football for him. He still does NFL on Fox every Sunday. He does have four children. He was able to spend some time off that he hadn't had, I think, since, I don't think ever. You know, he played 15 years and then went right into a sitcom. And then, you know, the Live with Kelly and Michael job. So that's why we waited. And it wasn't about addressing it. It was, you know, this is behind the scenes with me and my family, the side that, you know, you don't get to see. So that was it. And then, speaking of the art of negotiation, our cover got bumped 2 days later for Brangelina. So you could probably teach them something, Chris, about negotiation.
Has publicity played a role in what you do when it comes to negotiating?
Yeah, all the time. But I'm going to hear a little bit about her because she keeps asking us questions. Because
but I'm so shy for those of you that don't know me.
One thing, a couple things that I want to make, I hope that we bring up before we get done. But when we were talking the other day, I asked her how she was perceived in the industry, how people perceive her. And what did you say? Do you remember?
Yeah, I said, I think I'm seen as a straight shooter.
Right. And so... And I'll give her a chance to talk a little bit more about that. But that, again, this gets back to this confrontation thing I was talking about. Because it's not confronting like Donald Trump, which is an attack. But you do have to put stuff forward. So if someone describes you as a straight shooter, then she, and that's what her peers describe her as, then she's honest and she's straightforward. She's careful how she says it. But she makes people know what, sure, they know what the problems are. And she says it in a way that they can hear it, and she's honest. And that's what is all wrapped up in a straightforward. Now, within the FBI, while I was still with my colleagues for the longest time, I prided myself on being direct and honest. You know, and that description is not the same because people describe me. Then one of my colleagues once said, Chris, sometimes dealing with you is like getting hit in the face with a brick.
So what kind of friend says that?
Someone who is direct and honest.
Okay, all right.
But if you think of yourself as direct and honest, then you're too harsh. And you'll get described differently. But they described her as straightforward. So when you communicate with people, I mean, what do you try to be conscious of?
Well, I think I'm conscious of my relationship with whoever I'm talking to. You know, if it's on the Oprah show and I'm negotiating for a guest to come on, which, you know, the big misconception is that everybody wanted to be on Oprah, and really that's not true. Many people did, but sometimes the platform was too big for them, or they weren't willing to do an interview with her with no holds barred, you know, no. We had every question had to be on the table. We couldn't negotiate that. But I think, you know, I think what I worked hard to do was establish relationships and establish rapport. Because as we've talked about, or you talk about in the book, you're going to see that person again. You're going to intersect with that relationship again. And so being honest and truthful, but still getting what I want, was critical, and that everybody felt good at the end. I don't necessarily, and you might feel differently, we can talk about it, but I don't feel like I have to win a negotiation. It's not always about winning and losing. I like to go into it where everybody gets a win, and I think that's possible. You know, it might be how many segments we're negotiating or how much time for a certain guest, or they want to bring their co-star and no one's really ever heard of the co-star. So there's a lot of negotiations that go into what ultimately happens, but I'm not sure it's a zero-sum game in that. But I think relationships are really important. And we've, you know, I wondered too about when you're negotiating with hostage takers, do you have to establish a rapport? Do they trust you? Do you trust them out of the gate? You're not really necessarily starting on equal ground. So can you tell us a little bit about
that? Well, there's kind of three things there. I mean, yeah, yes, rapport, absolutely. Trust, we talked earlier, and I think we'll get into this some too. You take the word out, trust, and put in predictability. I'm looking for predictability. And then one thing that I always knew was true, but I had a colleague of mine articulate it once, because a friend of mine was a hostage negotiator with the UN, and back in the 80s, when Lebanon was absolute chaos, and there were lots of Westerners that were getting taken hostage, he was a UN hostage negotiator that got all the Westerners out of Beirut in the 80s. And it was crazy, yeah, absolutely crazy. And he said, you know, the other side doesn't ever expect you to be fair or even that you like them. What they really want from you is the ability to deliver the goods. So then when people know that what you say is they can rely on, then you can start to develop a working relationship with anybody. Anybody other than someone who's actually schizophrenic. But other than that, it doesn't matter. My rules for negotiation, from hostage negotiation, with how I could deal with people, how I define empathy, which is simply the same way sociopaths do. I just understand where you're coming from. On that narrow ground, I could develop a working relationship with anybody that'll talk to me. Pick the baddest guy on the planet, and I can develop a working relationship with him.
Have you ever run into someone who is holding a hostage, or you're in a situation, a very contentious situation, and you don't have the goods, you don't have what they want to have the situation calm down and dissipate?
All right, so if they're talking to me, I got something they want. That's why I've always said there's always leverage. If they're talking to me at all, no matter how big or how small it is, I've got something they want. So if I'm just patient and I don't push too hard, then all I got to do is very gently, no matter how big that threat is, I just pull that threat. They don't necessarily have to be talking to me. If they're communicating, there's something they want. And you asked me before, did we ever communicate through the media? All the time. Because we would, and D.C. sniper case was one of them. We started coaching the chief to say things in the media that because we knew they were listening. They weren't talking directly to us, but we knew everything we said they were going to hear. And they eventually called in. And Chief Moosey was fantastic. You know, you may be sort of forgotten in time now, but one of the things that he did that was amazing, we're coaching him. We're saying, say these things. They're going to hear them. And so the press calls him out at a press conference. And they say, Chief Moose, you know, how can you were almost respectful of snipers. And we hadn't prepped him for this. We didn't expect it. And he wasn't ready for it. He looks down. And he looks up and he says, my parents taught me to be respectful. And it never came up again. Mm-hmm. But and we were absolutely communicating to it because we knew they were listening. So if they're listening, if they're communicating at all, they don't have to be communicating with me. I can influence them.
So to go back to your original question, I think those are two other key points when we talked about what's important in a negotiation in addition to listening is patience. Because you have to have patience. Because I mean, I know I'm one of the most impatient people. My husband will back that up as well as Michael Strahan. But also, just it's hard because you want to get right in there and you want to get that end result. So I just think that's something that we should all take into account is the patience.
When is it okay or when is it right to walk away from a negotiation?
I was watching the video earlier and I really connected with it. It's like this is a blue-collar city. And I grew up in Yonkers, New York, which is another blue-collar city. And everything for me, you know, that I've worked for has been on my own. So everything's my gut. I'd love to sit here and sound as smart as you, you know, and yes, Chris. Because when we met last week and we had this amazing lunch and I emailed Cindy and I was like, I'm obsessed with Chris. Because what I do is from my gut. And then talking to Chris, he's giving me the scientific, you know, I think background and the mythology on it. And I was like, wow, okay, like, so I've kind of figured it out on my own. So I think, long-winded way to say, is when your gut tells you to walk away, it's okay. You know, and it's different for you because you're saving someone's life. For us, it's you know, it's business deals, it's contracts, it's endorsements, you know, it's also even just, you know, negotiating our new rent or our new building, like things like that. So I don't think you could just blanket that answer by saying there's a good time or a bad time. For me, it's just always been like a gut check. Like if I really think that we're done and the person on the other side is not going to, you know, negotiate any further, that's when I think I've walked
away. And how often when you walk away, do the other side come back to the table?
Well, look at all my clients on their television shows right now.
Yes, we should say she has Michael, Deion Sanders, Tony Gonzalez, Aaron Andrews. I mean, the list of people go on and on. So,
but there's also, Deion's a good example. I mean, how we first met was Deion had a show on the OWN network called Deion's Family Playbook. And I think it was after the second season, OWN decided not to re-up them for another season. We had no choice. There wasn't a negotiation. It was like, you know, it wasn't like we could go back and say, what if, you know, we cut the budget, you know, by this percentage, or what if, you know, we cut the seasons down? It was like, okay, you know, we just had to take it. So, and that's hard. I'd love to sit here and pretend like, oh, it's so easy. It's not. You know, you just, and I think that's where the patience comes into play for both sides. And then you also just have to know, and I'm a firm believer in this, that when that window closes, and I say window, a big door is going to open. Might not be that day, that week, might not even be that year. But I've been in business. I've had my own company for 6 years, and I started working. I graduated college in 1990, and have worked nonstop all the way through. And I've had great bosses and mentors, and I've had some really not-so-great bosses. And they definitely, I would love to say they weren't a mentor, but they were a mentor in who I didn't want to be. So I just think it's important that you don't take your eye off the prize. And it might not be what you, like, you might think, like, this job is it for me. It might not be. You know, and even if you get into a situation where the job that you're in turns out not to be what you thought it was, like, I worked for a record company for 11 months. I didn't make it to the 12th month because I was like, this is not for me. But had I not done that job, I wouldn't have realized that I didn't want to be in the record industry, number one. And number two, I made some great friends, but I also learned a lot of lessons on how I didn't want to operate in business. So
I'm going to jump in real quick, too, because there's a bunch of things that she said that I think she's really good at. So and first of all, it's
my negotiator.
How she walks away. And she just said it, because most of the time when we imagine closing out a deal, like somebody slams their hand on a table, screams and calls your names and runs out the door. But she just said one of the ways, she said, this is not for me. You know, if you're going to walk away, she didn't say, you're a horrible person, this is a horrible job, a lot of name calling. So the way that you walk away also sort of leaves your environment for your future. And the ability to walk away, you know, let out no a little at a time. She probably never walks away abruptly. She's probably sent people a number of signals along the line to try to let them know that there are problems here. You know, I'm getting close. And then when the time comes, it's not this wild demonstration of name-calling and hand-slamming. It's as probably as harsh as she could ever say. It was, this is not for me, and walk away. And that's a great way to end a negotiation, because you never know when you're going to see people again.
Oh, and you will. I guarantee you. I promise it. You know, I started as an assistant at the NFL in 1991, and to this day I will not forget the senior executives who were not so nice to me on my way up, because as I started my climb in my career, sure enough, those people then needed something back from me. Mm-hmm. I'd love to tell you I took the high road every time. Almost every time.
Is it hard to negotiate for yourself?
Oh, I'm the worst. I mean, it just
happened. You're the worst?
I'll give you a perfect example. So we just had to take some photos out here before we came in, and I hate stuff. Anything having to do with me, I don't like it. Walked back out, and Cindy was like, well, did you get photo approval? I'm like, no. Like, so I was like, maybe you can go ask for it for me, you know? And I ran back. But if I'm negotiating for someone, I am a killer. I mean, Dion calls me the pit bull in pumps. Not today, I'm in sneakers, but... I will kill, and well, not literally FBI agent, spiritually, emotionally, I will kill and fight for those, you know, that I'm negotiating for, but I'm not great at it for myself.
Chris, I have a feeling you're pretty good at negotiating for yourself.
You know, I had to get used to it, though, I mean, very much, because for a long time, I was doing it on others' behalf, and when it's your own skin in the game, it takes a readjustment. You have to go back and you have to get used to it. And then what were the rules for me when I did it for other people? But it is harder when it's for yourself. What about you?
I'm pretty good at it. You know, this question has come up a lot this week as we've been talking about doing this panel, whether it's called the art of negotiation, but is negotiation an art or is it a science?
I'm going to say both, because one thing that I've learned through this whole process is what I'm doing, like just the tactical of it all, I love Chris explaining the science behind it. So I think it is an art and a science. And I mean, in your case, I do this a lot. I'll come back to my point. When they first asked me to do this, I was like, no way. Like, sit with Chris, like, who negotiates people's lives? Like, absolutely not. And Cindy, who does fight for herself very well and also convinced me, you know, to do this. And I'm so happy to be here, because I've learned so much about what I've been doing right and maybe some of the things that I could learn to improve upon. I mean, just at breakfast this morning. So I just think that is an art to it and a science. And everything that you've told us, and I've read your book, which was amazing. I was like, oh my gosh, like, I've done that. Oh, I didn't do this. You know, you always can get better at it. So I think there's an art to how you negotiate, and the science is everything you've taught me in such a short amount of time.
Thanks. No, but the art part of it, here's the good news for everybody else. It's effectively emotional intelligence. And there's really solid data out there now that says, like, your IQ is fixed. It's like your height. It's only so tall you're going to get, no matter how much milk
you
drink.
Well, that sucks. I'm looking back up to here.
But your EQ, your emotional intelligence, the data shows that we can now improve that up to and through our 80s. And I think that that's only going to extend, because that's kind of the limit of functioning business people in their mid-80s now. So you can, no matter where you think you are in emotional intelligence, if you just start to work on it at all, you can immediately begin to build on it. And what it comes back to is something that Constance said a few minutes ago. She said her instinct on whether or not to do the deal. Instinct is recognition. Instinct is emotional intelligence. The more you work at it, the better. Allow yourself to make mistakes, because that's how you learn. And you make these calls and you make decisions. And every time, your instinct gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And it's better, and you can rely on it more. It can be built up in anybody.
But are there personality traits that good and great negotiators have inherently? Or can you learn to be that way?
Right, there's three types. It's our caveman default. It's fight, flight, and make friends. Caveman meets a saber-toothed tiger or something he doesn't know, and this is a part of the brain that hasn't evolved, the amygdala. It's the same thing. All our thoughts go through it. Your first instinctive response is either fight, flight, or make friends. The great negotiators develop all three of those abilities. So whatever your default type is, you don't change that, you add to it. If my default type is fight, assertion, you got to have assertion to be a good negotiator. The flight is a highly analytical person. You have to be able to do some analysis. Make friends is relationships. You have to have the ability to foster relationships. Whichever one of those three types you are, that's a necessary component. You don't have to change that out. You just have to add to it.
So let's talk about some practical negotiations that we all have. So raise your hand, let's say, if you want a raise at work. Who wants a raise?
Put your hand down.
Well, whoever, raise your hands high. So whoever doesn't want a raise, I have no idea what you're doing here. So let's talk about practical things, buying a car, buying a house, getting a raise. How do you do that if you are not a natural negotiator?
You go first.
Oh, boy. Okay, so I've been on both sides of it. I worked for companies for a very long time, and now I have my own company. So, and Jose Diaz, who works with me, who's come to me for a raise. So, you know.
We have a real-life example.
We have a real-life example.
Stand up, Jose. Wave to the crowd. So, you wanted a raise, Jose?
Jose? He's a hostage.
I think I'm the hostage. So it's twofold. What has worked for me in the past was, don't go in and just say, I want a raise. You have to have a reasonable, I think, goal. You know, if you go in like, I want $100,000, well, it depends where you work. But, you know, don't go in with a pie in the sky ask. Have something set in the sights that you know they're not going to flinch, you know, and just be like, you know, you're not making any sense. You haven't really thought this through. Like, it's really important to go in with, like, and reasons why you deserve that. So just a real life example for me was, I worked for a company when I moved to Los Angeles, and I hated LA when I first moved out there, and I was renting a place, but then a condo came open that I was going to purchase, but I didn't have enough money for the down payment. So I went to the owners of my company, and I just said, listen, you know I don't like it here. You know I want to move back to New York, but there's a condo that's opened up. So I'm willing to, like, stick my flag in here at the beach in, you know, in sunny California and stay here, but I need help with the down payment. So that should give you guys some incentive to know that I'm willing to stay here. Will you do that for me? And I gave them the number and, you know, the reasons. And it took them about, I don't even know, till the end of the day to say yes. So that was a good negotiation. Now, fast forward, a couple years later, I was managing Snoop Dogg. And when I first went into the company, my contract at the time wasn't to be a manager. So I didn't know to negotiate for, like, a percentage of what's brought in. So after every huge tour, and I would say to the company, so, you know, I brought this much money into the company, I think I deserve a bonus. And they said, yeah, you do, but we had, like, you had a great year, but the company didn't, so sorry, but thanks for keeping the lights on. And I wasn't prepared. You know, like, I didn't go in and say, these are the numbers, this is what it took, and I should have gone in to renegotiate a contract for myself. Now, here I am 10 years later, learning all I've learned, reading your book. I would have gone in with what I told you guys. You know, go in with your list of what you're asking for and why you deserve it. And that's how it worked for me. Good and the bad. But the bad, I learned a lesson.
Chris, you write about it in the book, right? How to get a raise. So give us a few tips.
All right. Well, salary is a term. Just like in any deal, price is a term. And no term can stand by itself, but a lot of people think, give me a good salary and things are going to be great. Now, what she did in her negotiation, the first one to get the down payment, she changed her mind to a point in time in the future. If you want me to stay, if you want me to be part of the continuing success of the company, that's what you want, negotiating something good in the future. What I want is a way to get there. And so that's a sequence. And as long as in your job negotiation, because You need your salary today, but you got to position yourself for next year also. Yes is nothing without how. What are the terms? What's it going to look like in a year? And as soon as it's pegged to the future, now the boss's mind is open. Because normally bosses see employees as very selfish people. Only time the employee comes walking into my office is when they want something. I want a raise. I want this. I want that. But the employee that's coming in now talking about something in the future that has to do with our future success, that's a completely different game plan. I've got a friend of mine, a high school buddy in Los Angeles now, phenomenally successful business executive. head of an international bank for the United States. He's always made it a part of every job that he's had to bring up the discussion, how will I be guaranteed to be involved in strategic projects that are important to the future of the organization? And all of a sudden they go like, I'm sorry, what? Because now what he's saying is, how do I make the rest of you guys prosper? And that puts him in a completely different light. They're talking about the future now, the prosperity. When she talked before, she says, I love it here, but I can't stay. And she's implying that, you know, there's a future issue at stake here. And as soon as you start talking about how are we successful together in the future, that puts you in a different light. And secondly, even when he gets turned down, the top levels of his company know his name. And he gets visibility with the people who are concerned about the strategic future of the organization. And not only has he hates it when I say he has no resume. He and I are both from small towns in Iowa. He's got an undergraduate degree. He's got no special education. He's got no connections. He's got no alumni. He's got no support network other than his own ability to see that the future is always important. And not only is he ridiculously successful, but people love to come work for him, too, because that's a component of everybody that works for him. He says, what do you want your life to be? Where do you want, you know, what's your biggest goal in your life? How do we make that possible? He retains people for longer than anybody else in his industry, and he doesn't even pay the highest salaries. He's not, because he's partnering with people in his future wherever he goes. Hostage negotiators, the same thing. I get somebody barricaded on the other side. First words out of my mouth is, I want you out of there alive. I don't call and ask for the hostages. First thing I check on is I want him to know there's a point in the future that the two of us can agree on. I want you to be alive when this is over. What it looks like after that is open to discussion. But that's me agreeing on a point in the future that we both want. And then that changes how they see you no matter what the circumstances are.
Do you think that gender plays a role in this?
Which part?
In getting a raise? Does it matter if you're a man or a woman? You had an experience, I think, with the NFL once.
So, no, and I'll tell you why. Because it goes back to what we talked about, like your negotiating skills. So when I started at the NFL, I was 21 or 22, and that was the best boys club you could ever learn from. People ask me if I got an MBA. I'm like, my MBA was at the NFL. And I loved every minute of that job because it taught me to stand up for myself. And I think that you could blame it on being a woman. And back then, there was no human resources. There was no overtime. There was no politically correctness. Like, but that made me stronger in who I am today. So there was an incident in my early 20s where somebody, there was like a volunteer kind of position on the weekends to go to games to, the internal like joke was called shoe police, but you would go and you would check during the games like what players had which sneakers on, if they were spatting, if their socks were at this level, their jerseys had to be a certain way. It was a lot looser back then than it is now, but still, I mean, a very serious business. And I went to ask if I could do it, and the person said, no. And I was like, is it because I'm a girl? I mean, back then I still think I'm a girl, but I think that's politically correct. So I was like, is it because I'm a girl? And they said, well, you know, what if you get hurt? I said, that's on me. I'll sign something if I need to sign something, but that's on me. Give me a chance. If I don't do well at it, I'll never bring it up again. I'll never bother you again. And they let me go, and the person who was in charge of it actually ended up getting hit by a football player on the sideline and getting a concussion, knocked out cold. Who is a man? It was great. It was a great experience, and it was also at the time I didn't realize that I was learning to negotiate for myself. So I'd love to sit, you know, and blame everything. There is gender inequality. I'm not saying there isn't, but for me, I just have had to fight for every step of the way in my career. And there was another instance when I was there where I was a newly promoted assistant. And with a male coordinator, we were given a golf tournament that the NFL put on to run it together. And I ended up running it, and the guy I was working with was on some other project, and we were brought in to the boss, who was a man. And so he was looking at the other guy, Jay, like, what's going on with this? And Jay's like, Constance was doing it. He's like, what? And so they asked Jay again. He's like, and so then I said, Don, like, I'm the one that should go to the sponsor and explain to them everything that's happening. And he said, Con, how can I send a newly promoted secretary in to meet with the president of Brand X? And I was like, fine, send Jay, because he's going to have no effing idea what he's talking about. And I got up and walked out. So I guess that would be a little aggressive. It worked. You know, the boss, I don't want to give anybody's names out. That's what I'm being.
Yeah.
And that boss, though, turned out to be one of the greatest mentors of my career. He's still involved in my life. And we both learned something that day. And that's why I don't like to blame my gender. I don't like to blame where I was. Like, I think you need to take everything that's brought your way and learn from it and grow. And that's why I'm not. I mean, you guys will probably disagree and say, well, you know, gender discrimination. But you know what? It was what it was. It just was a different time, I guess, back then. So,
you got to answer that.
What was the question?
Does gender matter in negotiations?
I don't think that it should. I do think, you know, I do think that men and women might grow up perhaps differently and be taught to ask for things in a different way, but it shouldn't matter. And I'm not sure that I've had any experiences where it did.
So, Chris, has there ever been I don't know what you call them, like people that, the terrorists or whatever, has there ever been a female that you've had to negotiate against?
No, we've never had one on the other side, but we have plenty of female hostage negotiators. And
what are the differences? How is their approach different?
Well, what you guys are saying, it matters if they're good. It doesn't matter what the gender is. Now, you know, that being said, I know that there are certain types of hostage negotiations, a very specific profile. If I put a woman on the phone and she's any good, it's going to be over in about 5 minutes.
Why is that?
But she's got to be good first. Because there's certain bad guys, if you will, that they've never had a woman listen to them before. And the minute a good listener gets on the phone with them, who happens to be willing to listen. It was a guy at home in Louisiana. It's been quite a while ago. An on-duty deputy sheriff pulled a woman over with his cruiser and raped her, left his business card, proceeded to a bank where his wife worked, who was separated from him, shot a couple people inside and took everybody hostage. He was a dysfunctional male, and she was leaving him, and he went nuts. And, of course, law enforcement first shows up, and they show up on the scene of a bank alarm, and they see a deputy sheriff's cruiser outside with no deputy sheriff. And first they think that he's a hostage. Later on they find out that he's a hostage taker, and he's committed a rape in uniform and shot and killed somebody in the bank. Now, a woman talked him out. Some of that was the fact that everybody that got on the phone with him before that, some of his colleagues, some of his friends, they actually tried to talk him out. And female hostage negotiator Gloria Newport, superstar negotiator, very good friend of mine, retired from the Bureau. She did some phenomenal things. She got on the phone and she said, "What happened?" She was the first person that was willing to listen. They'd actually literally been talking to him on the phone for over 24 hours. I listened to the tapes. One of his colleagues, he literally says on the phone to his colleague, "Would you let me speak?" But the first time somebody was willing to listen to him, got it out of him, and he was out about 2 hours later.
Wow. Is negotiating, we talked a little bit about this earlier, is it always a zero-sum game in a hostage situation? Because getting the person out alive is the only thing that matters, right? So how do you evaluate a situation if you don't get the person out alive? Has that happened?
I haven't had anybody die in a contained siege, although it happens. I've had kidnappings that didn't turn out the way I wanted them to. And we saw that, and you can usually see that stuff coming. And we now know enough about this stuff, you can see it coming. It's the issue of whether or not you can head it off. Mm-hmm. But the zero, you know, and it's the same way that I negotiate in business now. Like, my money's important to me. So I want to get as much as I can through emotional compensation before I ever start talking money. So hostage negotiator was just like all emotional compensation. You know, let's see how far we can get by hearing them out, finding out what's bothering them, finding out what's driving them, reframing certain things, making them feel more in control. Mm-hmm. And so in business and in any other thing, get as far as you can before you start throwing money on the table, right?
Right. I think another, just on the ground example, when Michael and I have been friends for about 20 years. We met when I worked at the league, and when we started working together, it was right after he retired, and he had another marketing agent, and the athlete mentality back then was just, you know, get what you can, get what you can. So he had about five, I think, endorsements and commercials going on. And I looked at him and I just said, listen, I don't know what's going to come. I said, but you've got to just let these all run out. I said, there's nothing here, in my opinion, that's helping to build your brand right now. And so let's let them go. And he was like, are you crazy? He's like, this is so much money. And did I said, Michael, I don't make money when you're not making money. So if I'm telling you to pass on something where it's going to be a big check for me and I need the money way more than you need it, then just trust me on this. And it took him probably about, I don't know, a couple days to just like sort of let it, you know, settle and situate. And he came back and he said, all right, I get it. And when he goes out and does speaking engagements, it's one of the first stories he'll tell, is you've really got to, you know, just understand what you're negotiating for. Even though we didn't know it would, you know, be these amazing TV opportunities, we still knew he was, you know, destined for some great things to come. So I think less is more in a lot of cases. Obviously not less harm in your case.
All right, I think we're ready to take questions for the panel. Do we have any questions? I think there's a mic coming around, so just wait for the mic and then ask away.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My question is around walking away. Can you talk about using it as a tactic and maybe feigning walking away when you're maybe not ready to truly walk away, and about the risks of using it as a tactic?
Yes, is that for me or all of us? Don't ever fake walking away, ever, because be prepared. You know, they might tell you we're done. So that's just my opinion. Is if you're threatening or, you know, walking away, you better be ready to walk away. Cindy, you.
Can you ever walk away?
You know, well, there's a couple different distinctions. Just because you can't, because you're not going to walk away doesn't mean say yes to start with. You know, don't be the hostage to yes. The discussion can continue. And then I can communicate that, look, if we don't deal with each other in a certain way, then this conversation is over. We had a kidnapping in Colombia, and they got a 12-year-old boy that's kidnapped, and we're advising a kidnapper and claiming that they're hurting the kid. So we got to get this off the table to continue the discussions. We coach the mom up to say, she said, let me be clear. I will work with you. I will never work with anybody that will harm a child. So she drew a hard line in the sand there. So continued the conversation, but drew a hard line on unacceptable behavior. And they never talked about her and the kid again.
Oh, congrats to all of you on the panel. You have amazing careers. So thanks for sharing your stories. My question for you is, for Constance, how have you built your roster of clients? You have such an impressive list of clients that you work with. So how have those relationships formed and continued to be so successful?
Thank you, first of all. Let's see. It's a lot of the guys I knew, you know, like Michael and Tony, I met when I was at the NFL, and just we were friends, you know, more than anything. And then Dion I met briefly early on in both of our careers. And when I was managing Snoop, we started the Snoop Youth Football League, and we were playing the Snooper Bowl in Dallas. And Snoop was playing Dion's team. And so Dion reached out to me a couple months later. And actually, this is another form of negotiation. So Dion called me and said, hey, I'm putting together a new team for my marketing. Could you tell me who handles Snoop? I was like, well, I do. He said, okay, well, could you introduce me to the people that handle all of Snoop's marketing and appearances and things? I'm like, well, it's me. He said, well, who does his bookings? I said, well, for the touring, we have an agent, but everything runs through me. You know, I'm the captain, the quarterback, you know, the coach, the general manager, whatever you want. It all runs through me. He's like, oh. I said, well, do you want to meet with me? He's like, oh, yeah, I'd love to meet with you. So And it was a good learning experience for me because I didn't understand he was negotiating to get me to ask him to meet with him. So that's how I met him. Erin Andrews, another friend who I met through Michael, and then she approached me. Kurt Menefee came to me for advice. I met him through Michael, and he just came for some advice. And it was one of those, like, wow, you know, really talented. You know, would you want to work with me? He was like, I didn't even come here thinking that, but yes. And then Wiz Khalifa's lawyers are friends of mine, and they called me a couple of years ago. And I initially said no, negotiation for them on their part, because when I stopped working with Snoop, I was done. Like, I had a great run with him, 7 years, 49 dog years, right? And as soon as I turned 40, I was like, I've run out of gas with you. I love you. I'll be friends with you forever. But I was done. And so when the lawyers called me, I was like, no. And it wasn't a negotiation tactic. I was in St. Bart's partying with my husband and Michael, and we were all out there. And I hung up, and they're like, what was that about? Actually, they were negotiating. I said, that was with his lawyers, you know, wanting me to take a meeting. They're like, are you crazy? You call them back and say you'll take the meeting. I said, are you guys crazy? I said, you're not going to be the ones on the front lines. You have no idea what goes into managing a hip-hop, you know, rapper, artist, entrepreneur, et cetera. And they said, good point, but we don't care. Call them back and take the meeting. And I'm so glad they had me do that because this is from Wiz's new line that he's doing with his son, Sebastian. It's bashed by Wiz Khalifa for parents and their kids. Little plug there, Jennifer Duggar. But it's been such a great run for me. And it was good because I took 5 years off of working in the music industry. And another thing I think we talked about was when I started working with Wiz, I said, just so you know, I'm not looking to be back in the music business per se. And he was like, I know that. And that was one of like a couple people, like other managers bidding against me, used that against me, saying she's been out of the game for so long. I said, I look at it as a positive. I said, I still know what's evolving, and the music business has evolved and it's in such a different state now. I said, so I think it's a positive. And the second thing is, I'm never going to negotiate against you because I'm worried about upsetting the record company or the publishers or Billboard magazine. Like, I'm always going to make the decisions that are best for you on your behalf, instead of like, if I make this decision, it's going to piss off the label and I've got another artist over there. So it's not always the case. But
let me jump in on that, because I know that both of these ladies are very good at that, and it gets to trust. And trust means, will you put your interests in front of mine? And she's already given a couple examples where she was willing to put what was best for the client ahead of what's best for her. That's a problem with a lot of agents. Like, I'm not going to ruffle feathers in the industry. I'm not going to stand up for you. I'm not going to walk away from this deal because I'm worried about how I'm perceived. She doesn't care about that. And I know you don't either. You guys, both of these ladies work, they think first, what's best for the people I'm working for? Mm-hmm. And then I worry about me afterwards. Correct?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Oprah, obviously known by one name around the world, and everything that we do, and I know there are some former Harponians in here. We call ourselves Harponians from Harpo and all that. But, you know, we represent Oprah all the time, whether we're at home, whether we're out to dinner, whether we're at work. And so when I was negotiating to have a guest on the show, It wasn't about me. It wasn't about me wanting to meet that person or that I necessarily want to know everything about their story, but it was, is that a good fit for her? Is that the right person to put next to her? Is that something that is going to resonate with the audience? And so when you represent other people, you know, it does make it easier, I think, sometimes to walk away when it doesn't feel like the right thing. And it's not something to take personally. It just doesn't work out for whatever reason. So I think it is important when you're representing someone to think about their interests and take yourself out of it, because then you're really being open to whatever could happen.
And I think that's an important note when you're negotiating, whether it's for a raise or for in a business deal, is put yourself in the other person's shoes and try to see what are they trying to get to, and how can you understand that, because then I think it'll help you get to a place of a happy medium. Because in my opinion, in negotiation, both parties are going to be happy, but there's also going to be a little maybe discomfort, like we didn't get this and this, but wow, did we get this? And that's a successful negotiation in my opinion, and for what I do. For you, it was different because someone's life is on the line. So it's just disclaimer.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Sorry. In the company that I worked for, we do have a lot of influence kind of thing. That is something that they encourage us to do. So I would like to know your opinion between negotiation and influence, because I see it differently, but it might be related. So what would be your thoughts around that?
Interesting.
That's Chris.
Negotiation is using influence and gathering information at the same time. Influence might just be the application of your influence, but real negotiation is pulling information real time while the negotiation is going on, so I can calibrate my influence, I can test my assumptions, test my hypothesis, I'm listening for the solid gold that I might not know is there. It's impossible to know everything, no matter how much research you do, no matter how much influence you have. You have to learn at the table and be able to adapt in real time. So negotiation is influence plus information gathering, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
Cindy, I have one right here.
Okay.
This question is for the panel, either one of you all. What do you do when you experience career burnout, or how do you rejuvenate your enthusiasm for your job?
I'll take that one. You know, I've been with Oprah for a really long time, whether it was on the Oprah Show or now with the network OWN. And, you know, for me, that when we talked about negotiating being an art or a science, I have learned a lot, actually, about it being a science, but I see it more of an art form, and it's fluid, and it's about flexibility and adaptability. And so the reason why I still love booking interviews and booking guests after all these years is because I learn something new every single day, and no two conversations, no two negotiations are ever, ever, ever the same. And I think that is specifically what has kept me from burning out on it. I look at each situation. How did I go into it? How did it work during the time of the conversations? And then at the end, was everybody happy? What I could have done better? What I might have said? How I should have communicated that? So it's a constant evolving learning process for me. And that's how I avoid burnout.
This question is for Chris. The title of your book is Never Split the Difference. It seems counterintuitive in negotiations. I'd like to hear a thought on that.
Yeah, well, you know, a couple different things. Somebody offers to split the difference, or somebody offers to meet you that halfway is usually a poor judge of distance. So it could be a tactic that you got to watch out for. So then, like, should we compromise? Should we split the difference? Like, you know, should I wear brown shoes or black shoes with this suit? Well, let's split the difference. I'll wear one black and one brown.
I'm looking at your shoes. I'm too black.
Yeah, so
right.
the spirit of compromise means that you're open to listening. But the practice of compromise, really, most of the time, is splitting the difference. The practice of it is one black shoe and one brown shoe. Let's take a little bit of your idea, a little bit of my idea. We're both tired. Let's go home. Let's call it a day. That's what politicians do, and look how effective they are in getting things done. So it happens a lot of times as a shortcut. It happens because we're tired. Now, there's a difference between high-value trades and splitting the difference. And what Constance was talking about in her deals is, all right, so we gave this up. We wish we could have, but look what we got over here. Well, that's the definition of a high-value trade. That's smart business. You want to give something up that you can give easily because they have something that you really want that they could give easily. You know, it's the guy who's the farmer who talks to the guy who makes shoes. I'll give you some crops, you give me some shoes, because that's the business that we're in. So I don't want to confuse high-value trades with compromise or splitting the difference. The other problem with compromise and splitting the difference is our caveman brain, we are wired, and this is actually a Nobel Prize in behavioral economics, tells us that we experience losses twice as much as we enjoy gains, which means if I beat you out of $5, then you're going to want to get me back for 10 before you feel like we're even. And it's in the sports world that people have said, you know, losing the Super Bowl hurts twice as much as winning it feels good. So if loss stings twice as much as an equivalent gain, and we start splitting the difference, yeah, I beat you out of 5. You're not going to be happy till you get me for 10. You get me for 10. Now I'm not going to be happy till I get you for 20. It becomes a vicious circle. So compromise is also a very dangerous thing to do, because when I give something up to get something, it stings me, and I'm going to want to get you back in a way that you perceive to be unfair. So it's just a difficult road to go down without having things go bad.
Yeah, so you talked about over-communication before. Is there ever a concern with over-communication that you'd be showing too many of your cards?
It depends on what you're over-communicating. So I have, like Cindy, I'm a straight shooter. I mean, it's just the way, good or bad. Like, my friends will always say, if you really want Constance's opinion, don't ask her. And that's the same way it is with my clients. So I think it's, when you're over-communicating, it doesn't mean you're giving away your secrets or, you know, too much information from your side, but it's just always, this is where I want to end up. You know, like, when we're negotiating endorsement deals, luckily for us, Jose and I have relationships with most of the marketing agencies, and they know that when I'm saying I need to get to this number, I mean it. You know, it's not, and that's because I've been very truthful and have over-communicated, because there's a lot of people that I think don't do that, and that, you know, can work against you. So I just think it's not about telling too much, and that's what I mean, that's not what I meant by over-communicating. It's just, don't keep too many things thinking that the other side knows what you're thinking, because they don't. They really don't. You give, this is one thing I've learned, the people on the other side, don't give them too much credit. They're not knowing, they don't really know what you're thinking. And sometimes you just have to tell them, so.